Hey, before we get started today, I have a request. For the December episode, I'm trying something a little bit different. Instead of interviewing a few people to profile around a particular issue, I'm looking for more voices. Our topic, maybe unsurprisingly, is holiday celebrations. I want to hear stories of what December looks like for you and your family. Stories of celebrations of holidays in addition to Hanukkah. Stories of family members or friends who are not Jewish coming over to take part in Hanukkah celebrations, going to grandma's for Christmas, and well, you get the idea. Make a 3 to 5 minute audio recording using your phone, computer, tablet, whatever you've got. Email it to jewtopodcast, jewtoopodcast@gmail.com, and you could end up on our next episode. All ages, genders, races, geographies, denominational preferences, and experiences are more than welcome. Thanks. Jew 2, Tales of the Mixed Multitude, is made possible through the generous support of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College and the Auerbach Foundation's Innovation Grants. I'm Emily Cohen. Thank you for listening.
I was on the road to rabbinical school, and so actually our first main date was him driving me up to RRC for me to like come and visit and like meet some of the teachers. So like this has been part of our relationship ever since we've known each other. We've known that it's coming, which is probably like in some ways makes it an easier transition and like an easier life transition. My name is Mikey Hess Weber. I'm 32. Go to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. I'm in my second year. So I was raised in a interfaith home, kind of, because my mom was raised in a reform, like an American reform home, where, you know, their Jewish identity was sort of around the community they spent time in and the foods they ate, but none of them are really practicing Jews. And then my dad was raised in the Midwest in Michigan in a Methodist home. And so my dad, I don't think religion for my dad was ever very important. So when he met my mom, his religion sort of fell off, whatever his Christianity fell off. And like my mom kind of took that spot in his life. And my mom at this point, from my understanding, this was college, like post Nifty. She was like a fighter for like this reemergence of Judaism in her life. And so she and my dad kind of took that on together. And before I was born, maybe while I was like in the works, joined a Reconstructionist synagogue and raised me Reconstructionist. My dad, he was so supportive. He came to synagogue and wore a kippah and is the Jewish cook in our family. Never officially converted. I don't think my mom ever cared for him to do that, but read a lot of books on Judaism and has just been a present, like a Jewish presence in our life. I went to Hebrew school for my whole life, and then I got out of Hebrew school after confirmation and I joined BBYO and was an active member of BBYO until college. And then college came and I went to Hood College, which is really small, and there was no Jewish Student Union, so I made one, and I think there were 7 students that were involved with it, but it was nice to have a Jewish community on campus. I started with working with B'nai B'rith, and then I developed a youth program, became the youth director at a congregation in Maryland, and in the middle of those two things, I moved to Israel for a chunk of time. And so I think it was just like a sort of a crescendo kind of like growing up Jewish and then getting more and more like open to things and then sort of trying to create a career out of that Jewish identity and realizing that without the education, I felt like I was sort of plateauing in what I could do and really wanting to make that my life and not having the tools to really make it my life. And so I started to think, my rabbi actually called me into his office one day and was like, I think you need to go to rabbinical school. And that was really the start of me thinking about it and doing research about it. I think everything in life was leading me to rabbinical school. In seventh grade, I wrote an essay about how I wanted to be a rabbi when I grew up. But I think that really it was that conversation with my rabbi that really like was the thrust to be here. And yeah, so that started the journey. And that it was soon after that Scott drove me up here in a snowstorm to visit RRC.
If you listened to last month's episode about patrilineal descent, you'll know that stories like Mikey's are not unheard of in rabbinical school. Stories where Jewish children are raised by a Jewish parent and a parent who is not Jewish and grow up to be rabbis. That story alone is one worth telling. But it's not actually why Mikey is on this particular episode.
I was engaged before I applied to rabbinical school.
That doesn't exactly make Mikey stand out.
Scott was raised Lutheran.
Getting warmer.
His mom, who is amazing, is the daughter of a pastor. I think at a Lutheran church, but really an amazing woman with also a strong faith in God, but not a dogmatic religious person. Very kind and patient. And if there's like this view of Christianity that I want to subscribe to, it would be the view of my mother-in-law in like how loving and compassionate and non-judgmental she is in the world. So Scott, I think, comes from a really loving spiritual background.
This kind of setup isn't so unusual. Until recently, there would have been a fairly standard process. Scott, because he was partnered with a rabbinical student, would need to go through a process of conversion, ideally out of actual investment in the Jewish faith. But things are a little bit different now than they were, even 2 or 3 years ago.
I thought I was going to keep my mouth shut. I really did. I sort of would, you know, I figured that I would date and, you know, sort of keep a separate life. Sadly, kind of reminds me when I was in the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that when I initially thought about applying, I was in a serious committed relationship with another person who also happened to be a person of African descent. We went from thinking that she would convert to her was like, absolutely not. Trying to navigate that and still be in a relationship with someone was really hard and really challenging, and the relationship dissolved. So when I got here, I had a lot of bitter feelings around the non-Jewish partner policy.
You're listening to Sandra Lawson. She's also a student at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. She entered the school in 2011. At the time, the RRC had a policy that they would neither matriculate nor graduate a student in a committed relationship with somebody who was not Jewish.
I'm 48 years old. I'm also a Jew of color. I identify as Black. I hadn't had really good experiences dating Jewish people. I hadn't had great experiences dating a lot of white people. But I had great experiences dating some white people. I'm not trying to put all white people in the same boat. You know, the chances of me being Black, queer, and Jewish, odds were just not in my favor. But with that said, if everything was perfect and the world was fine, yes, I'd probably be fine with a Jewish partner. And I've dated some wonderful Jewish women, but I had an idea when I entered RRC that the person I would probably partner with would not be Jewish. My focus that year, the first year, was just trying to get through those first few years, trying to learn and trying to figure out how to navigate the space of being a rabbinical student. But then at some point, I was just like, I don't care. I'm gonna date. If I like someone, I'm gonna introduce this person to my friends, because it was just stupid. This program's a long time, and
regardless of the religious background of her dates, Sandra made sure to let them know what they were in for in dating her.
I told them that this is what the deal is, and I'm going to be a rabbi, and this relationship is going to be something serious. You need to understand this, because this is what I'm doing. There's nothing that's getting in my way. Yeah, it sounds kind of harsh. It's hard being a student and trying to meet people. It's hard being a rabbinical student trying to meet people. So I went on OkCupid. And OkCupid, I don't know what it's like now, but it was kind of fun. If you're kind of geeky, you could answer these questions, and it would give you numbers and stats about who was compatible and all that stuff. I had two friends of mine help.
Sandra's friends helped her to craft a profile that was a little bit less academic. She got a message from a woman named Susan, which apparently contained a hilarious explanation as to why Susan had no profile picture or any information on her profile page.
And it was so funny. And I took it to two friends of mine. I'm like, you've got to read this. And they're like, you have to meet this woman. And over the course of a few days or a day, I'm not sure, we exchanged emails and then phone numbers. And I was packing up to go out of town. And so I was out of town for about a week, which is kind of cool because we texted and emailed and called. So I got to know her a little bit before I met her. And when I came back, this person who I haven't met, we somehow came up with the idea that she would pick me up at the train station and we would go on a date, which was, yes.
Luckily for Sandra and for Reconstructionist Judaism, Susan was not an axe murderer. One date became many, and they got married in Philadelphia 2 summers ago. At the time, the RRC policy was still in effect, but Sandra still had 3 years of school to go, so Susan's background was a later problem.
Susan grew up Catholic. I don't think she liked it very much. She had, a traditional Catholic upbringing. And I'm saying that with little information. I know her family's wonderful, but I don't really know what a traditional Catholic education is. But I know that Susan was raised in a Catholic household. They went to Catholic school. Early on, I did tell Susan that, I know that we just started dating, but this is important. And she's like, we'll talk about it, but if I have to, I'll convert, But it was so, early in our relationship that it was just not a thing to worry about. When we first got together, I had two things that I was really particular about. One was food. I'm a vegan. For me, it makes it easy for me to keep a kosher household. And my veganism has a lot to do with health and my own sort of spiritual, not ethics, but values. And so I didn't want to be in a house that had non-kosher food or that had meat. And I was willing to compromise on some things, but not others. And I was really rigid about that. And actually, a lot of our early fights were around that. And I also refused to have any Christmas decorations. No wreaths, no Christmas tree. And then the first Christmas we moved in together, I think I went to the store and bought garland and put it around the TV or something. But I still refused to have a tree. I was just not. Then I went to Israel. And then I came back and I didn't get, it just sort of loosened me up. And I came back from Israel the day before Christmas or 2 days before Christmas. And I realized that I'm going to be a rabbi. This is a tradition that's important to my partner. It has nothing to do for her, for Jesus. It's just something that she likes. And so I came home and I said, let's buy a Christmas tree. And I didn't even know how to do that. I learned this whole process of buying a Christmas tree. So I don't know if we had a Christmas tree 1 year or 2 years, but after that, I've asked her since, does she want one? She's like, no. Because it's just too much trouble, she said.
Confession time. When I started putting this episode together, I didn't think that I'd be making an episode specifically about intermarried rabbinical students. But I interviewed Mikey and Sandra first, mostly because they're classmates of mine and easy to get a hold of. And I was so compelled by their stories that I thought, why not do an episode about this first generation of intermarried rabbis? Why not tell their stories? So don't worry, there will definitely be other episodes about interfaith partners and about the different ways that those partnerships work in different parts of the country for people of different ages, raising children, not raising children, all of that. It's a topic that I'm very committed to. But today, I'm putting two crucial voices into the world. Two people who, one within a matter of months and one within a matter of just a few years, will become religious leaders in the Jewish community, with their partners who are not Jewish by their side.
I had broken up with my previous boyfriend after 4.5 years because there was he was raised Catholic and I was raised Jewish, and whenever the conversation of having kids came up, it got really hard. So I think in the past religion had been really a dividing thing. But with Scott, it didn't feel quite that way, which is probably a testament to him as a person. I think he's a really open and loving person. And I also think it's a testament to sort of where I was Jewishly. Like, there's a difference. There was a difference in how I identified myself, I think, in that previous relationship, in terms of my strength of self and my strength of identity. So that now, when partnered with someone who's not Jewish, it doesn't feel like a threat. Like, I'm going to have to sacrifice my Jewishness. It feels like we can coexist. Scott is not, I think he's on a spiritual search for meaning and truth, but he is not of a religion. So that also is, I don't know if that makes it easier or not, because I don't know what it's, but he's not, there's no competing thing. And it's sweet. Like, it kind of feels like we're on this journey together. Last Hanukkah, he bought me like 50 books about like the Zohar. That's like an access point for Scott, is the mysticism and the Zohar. And, you know, that's where he wants to jump into Judaism. He's not so into the like going to synagogue and like going through that ritual, although he does it with me sometimes. But that doesn't, I think meditation and like nature walks speak more to him. But that works well with my conception of Judaism too. So we talk about having children. They would be Jewish. And I think that the Judaism that I would bring them would really be infused with Scott's like spirituality, you know, his love of nature, like I said, and his love of the world and exploration. So I think they're going to be really cool. And I think, like, I pull upon, like, my childhood growing up and how I didn't come from the most religious home. I didn't grow up knowing, like, all the prayers through and through. I started rabbinical school with a lot of questions about Judaism, what Judaism says and tells us to do. But I'm here as a rabbi because I was raised with a lot of love and partnership and in a Jewish community that was really accepting and inclusive. I was raised in a synagogue where no one batted an eye that my dad wasn't Jewish. Like, it just was not a thing. So I don't always think, like, when people say things against intermarriage, which they do a lot, which is painful, I think that it doesn't always matter how much, like, tachlis Judaism we, like, give to our children.
Tachlis meaning practical, logistical.
Do they have to go to Jewish day school? I don't believe that. It would be great for them if they did, but I think it's more about like really loving them and teaching them why I love Judaism, you know? And I think that is like the home that I want to create, the Jewish home I want to create for them.
There's so much fear wrapped up in intermarriage. Fear that the faith of the partner who is not Jewish or the secularism will take control of the entire family. Fear that children raised in homes where there are two faiths being practiced or when one parent does not practice their faith will choose to marry people who are not Jewish and further dilute the Jewish identity that one of their parents possessed. Fear that marrying somebody who is not Jewish opens the door to a two-generation shift from Jewishly engaged to entirely disaffiliated from the Jewish community, except for perhaps an affinity for bagels. And yes, there are absolutely Jewish families where that happens, where somebody chooses to marry somebody of a different faith, raise their children in that faith, and set aside their tradition of origin. But there are also families like Mikey and Scott's, families that are completely committed to a Jewish future, and in which the partner who is not Jewish can have a positive influence on the religious and spiritual expression of the partner who is Jewish.
Scott and I were friends before. He knew that I was like very actively Jewish and active in the Jewish community. And so the idea of becoming a rabbi, I think, felt a little bit natural to both of us. I think probably for Scott, he didn't know exactly what it meant to have like a partner that was a rabbi, I would expect, but he never even batted an eye until I think he found out how expensive it was.
Newsflash, rabbinical school is graduate school. Hello, loans.
But he was like, great, we'll move to Philadelphia, which we didn't end up doing. We still live in Baltimore, but he was just totally supportive from the very start. There was never a moment where I was like, ooh, this is a hard conversation.
the conversation held within the Reconstructionist movement about whether or not to graduate students with non-Jewish partners was a very hard conversation, and it took place over a number of years in consultation with faculty, alumni, students, and congregations. This was happening in part while Sandra and Susan were settling into their lives together, not knowing whether or not Susan would have to undergo conversion for Sandra to be declared a rabbi. Sandra started bringing Jewish rituals to their home.
Hanukkah, Susan makes latkes, and lights the candles. I mean, I'll say the blessing. Most, like, serious Jewish holidays are spent in shul.
On Shabbat, they, like many interfaith couples and many Jewish couples, have a range of observances.
We light candles. We have dinner at home. Sometimes, though, just because I need a break, we still mark the time in some way, shape, or form, even if it's not candles. It could just be me saying it Shabbat. We use that time to do stuff together because we're so busy during the week. That could mean going out to dinner. That could mean hanging out with friends. And the special times are often when we both don't have anything to do, and then we really do make it like a special day at home. Like just like last Friday, I came home from work. I asked Susan if she could start making dinner and we lit the candles. And so, like, I like that, like marking the time. That's my ideal way of marking the time, Jewish time.
In September 2015, not long at all after Sandra and Susan's wedding, the RRC officially changed its policy and put out a press release saying, "The RRC has revoked its non-Jewish partner policy, which previously stated the RRC does not ordinarily admit or graduate as a rabbi a student married to or in a committed relationship with a non-Jew. After an extended process, RRC faculty voted on September 21st, 2015, to remove the barrier barring otherwise qualified candidates from applying to become rabbis. Simultaneously, RRC will cease the practice of disallowing current rabbinical students in good standing who are in relationships with non-Jews from graduating." The president of the RRC and of the Reconstructionist movement, Rabbi Dr. Deborah Waxman, stated, "The issue of Jews intermarrying is no longer something we want to police. We want to welcome Jews and the people who love us to join us in the very difficult project of bringing meaning, justice, and hope into our world." You can read the rest of the press release on the website. I'll put a link out. As you might imagine, reactions were mixed. Many in the Reconstructionist movement were very pleased by the decision, while a few actually chose to leave the professional organization of Reconstructionist rabbis. The Jewish press gave this decision a very poor reception on the whole, crying out that the Reconstructionist movement had become so porous as to become no longer relevant in policing boundaries. Then again, the Reconstructionist movement is used to things like this. We've been taking flack for our progressive social policies for decades, for allowing intermarriage in the lay community, for accepting LGBTQ rabbis, and of course LGBTQ marriage long before it was acceptable in most parts of society, for accepting patrilineal descent, and the list goes on and on. We can't know how this decision will be looked back upon in a decade or five, but we do know that Sandra is slated to graduate in June, and Susan has no plans to convert. Sandra will be the first person to graduate openly with a partner who's not Jewish.
Which is something that never even occurred to me until
Sally student mentioned it to her last year, and even then it didn't have much of an impact.
But it's since come up several times, but it was not something I've been tracking. I've had enough firsts in this building, like the first, you know, matriculating Black person. I've been asked over the years, not recently, but, you know, if I had to prioritize my identities, you know, which one would I put first? I've had white feminists say, "Well, what's more important to you, being Black or feminist?" I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And I've also had people ask me about, like, you know, pitting my other identities against each other. And I know, like I think what May said is great.
May E, one of our guests on the last episode, described her identity like this.
"Make a cut in my skin, and the blood is Jewish and Chinese. Like, you can't just pick and choose who I am. Like, this is who I am.
I know who I am, and they can't be separated. Like, it's all together. I will always see things through these different lenses, and it filters how I see things.
So how is Sandra relating to the idea of being a first in this particular way?
I don't know what it will mean. I mean, it could mean that we're not closeted about it. People ask that we talk about it. I don't know what the attention will bring or any of that kind of stuff. If I'm a rabbi in a congregation, I'll just use that example. I bring a lot, but it has to be with the right community. Like, there's just some places I just don't see how it's ever going to be a good fit. But one of the things that I think, having, you know, all these identities, I'm able to see the missing. I'm often able to see things that your typical average white Jew doesn't necessarily see. I think anyone who wants to have me as a rabbi is a community that wants to think that way, that wants to be more open, wants to have a big tent, wants to work creatively with their rabbi if it's me. And a lot of communities that I know of that are like that tend to be communities that were started because they didn't fit somewhere else. So, like, a lot of, like, gay-founded synagogues are communities like that, where they're much more open, have bigger tents, even if they're not predominantly gay anymore, you still have that foundation.
I think that it's really important to me that I don't work at a place that is going to have an issue with it. So I think I'm going to lead with it, because I want to be honest and I want everything to be on the table. I think people need to feel comfortable. I do not want Jews in my congregation feeling closeted about whatever they have in their closets that they hide from people. I want everyone, that's my ideal world, is like that everybody feels like they can bring their truth to the table. And I see that a lot in my congregation now, where this happened the other night at Kiddush, where I'm like meeting this couple and the husband wasn't, when they got married, he wasn't Jewish, but he's since converted. And both of them were like, so scared to tell me that. And I was like, that's cool. There's no judgment here, folks. Like, that's okay. That's whatever works for you, you know, but the amount of hesitation and anxiety that was around that, bringing that out, was painful for me to see, because it means people feel like they have to hide, and that doesn't feel to me like the best way to have community.
Unlike Sandra, Mikey never had the experience of needing to hide her interfaith relationship while a student at RRC. She was in the first cohort of students admitted to the college after the policy shift. And when questioned about her decision as a rabbinical student to partner with somebody who is not Jewish, she has a difficult time answering.
I have a really hard time even knowing why I have to respond. Like, I don't understand what the issue is. And even when people explain to me what their issue is, I just still don't understand. Because I think it's an issue that's born out of fear, not out of reality or, like, rationality of any kind. Obviously, I'm from an interfaith marriage where my spiritual life, I mean, the spirituality in my family comes from the Christian side of my family. I'm not Christian, and I'm going to school to be a rabbi. And in a community where we're talking so much about being inclusive for people who are different colors and people who have different learning needs and people who identify their gender differently, it's really strange to me. Like, it just doesn't make sense why we're not being inclusive to people who love someone who's a different religion, you know? So I get really frustrated. I get really frustrated when people bring it up as an issue at all. I just don't think that we can point our finger at one thing and say this is the reason why Judaism isn't growing faster, or this is the reason why people are leaving the religion. I think people are leaving religion because religion doesn't give people the space to be themselves. This is a generalization, because I don't believe that all about, but I think people feel alienated and people are looking for answers and spirituality that they're not finding, and people don't feel like they can be themselves and live their truth in certain communities. From my perspective, the way to like help Judaism grow is to let people be their true selves, let people love who they love, and stop controlling their movements, you know? Like, let people choose Judaism instead of forcing people to be Jewish. I think it's really important for us to change our narrative about who, like, who's in and who's out. And that's, this is something that's going to make Judaism stronger.
Deep thanks to Mikey Hess-Weber and Sandra Lawson, and by extension, to Scott and to Susan. As always, your feedback is very welcome. In addition to sharing your thoughts about this episode, I really do invite you both to contribute your voice to the next episode, and also to let me know what you want to see covered in the later winter months and into the spring. The best way to get in touch these days is through our website at JewToPodcast, JewToPodcast.com. There you'll find links to all of our social media accounts for Facebook and Twitter, SoundCloud, and the list goes on. Speaking of SoundCloud, I'm not the only person on this podcast with a podcast. Sandra has a significant social media presence. I'll let her tell you about it.
You can find me on Facebook at Rabbi Sandra, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Sandra J. Lawson, and I have a website at sandrajlawson.com, which houses all that stuff.
Sandra's podcast is super short, usually no more than 5 minutes. There are little nuggets of Torah, and occasionally also commentaries on holidays and her own original music. Check it out. We'll be back next month, but probably not until after Hanukkah. Depends on how quickly y'all get me those stories. I wish you all joy and light, and, of course, latkes. Lots of latkes.